third case for oral argument this morning is the South Dakota Board of Pardons and Paroles and Douglas Weber Warden Appellants versus Rodney Collins, Appellee. For the appellants, we have Max Gores, an Assistant Attorney General from Pierre, and for the appellee, we have Henry Evans, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Gores, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Max Gores. I'm a staff attorney with the Department of Corrections and an Assistant Attorney General. This case is primarily a question of law. Does an indigent inmate have a constitutional right to a court-appointed attorney at a parole board hearing to determine the length of his indeterminate sentence? In this case, Rodney Collins was convicted by plea of child abuse. The circuit court, Judge Kane, gave him an indeterminate sentence of 5 to 10 years. This was one of the last ones because this was handed down in 2003, and in 2004, the legislature repealed the indeterminate sentence law. The board held a hearing. Collins was sentenced on March 17th of 2003, and the board held a hearing on the 21st of November of 2003 and set Collins' sentence at 10 years, the maximum under the two terms possible.
Just logistics. The information they gave him is that he could request one, request an attorney.
They said that he could, yes. They said he could have his own.
Had he asked for one, then what would have happened? Would it have actually gone back to the circuit court judge then to determine whether or not he would get a lawyer? Or how would it work? How would it have worked had he asked for one?
It would go to the circuit court judge.
And then how would the circuit court judge determine?
Well, the circuit court judge would have to make that decision based on his or her experience.
So, but if they don't have a constitutional right to one, as you're arguing, then really the trial court would most likely deny it.
Well, it's possible that you wouldn't. For example, there's a statutory right in a parole revocation case that isn't based necessarily in the Constitution. In Gagnon versus Scarpelli back in 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court said, you don't have an absolute constitutional right under due process to have a court-appointed lawyer, but you might if you need one. And they said do it on a case-by-case basis. South Dakota solved that equation by just passing the law that said at probation and parole revocation hearings, you get a court-appointed lawyer. But it doesn't apply to indeterminate sentences. It just says in a final hearing for revocation of parole. And in fact, the Supreme Court made a point back in 2003 in Burgee versus the Parole Board to say there was no basis for the circuit judge to appoint a lawyer for the inmates who were suing the Parole Board to have appeals from their denials of discretionary parole. It was eventually worked out by the various counties they were from paid different parts of that, but this court said there is no right to that.
So what we would say then if there's no right is that when the trial court gave him that they really are giving him the maximum then.
That's right.
So whatever the maximum years they say in between this and this. And that their opportunity or the critical stage of that proceeding would have been at the hearing in front of the trial court when this trial court sentenced him. Is that basically what the analysis is on that side of it?
That's my position. It's clear that at court sentencing, you have a right. And Memphis versus Ray in our state case, I think it's put off, makes it clear that that is the stage where you're sure to get a lawyer. But the only thing that can happen to you at the indeterminate sentence hearing is you can get less.
Wasn't that critical, whether you get a 50% discount or not in your sentence?
If that's the case...
I would bet the inmate thought it was pretty critical.
I understand that. Inmates think it's critical to get a parole, a commutation, and a pardon, but they don't get lawyers for that. And when an inmate comes in to a circuit judge in arrest of judgment or for a suspended sentence or for a reduction of sentence under the three different laws that are available to circuit judges, they don't have an absolute right to a court-appointed lawyer. Circuit judges sometimes appoint them lawyers and often don't. Some of those are just handled, the inmate writes a letter to the court, and court writes back and says denied or granted.
Are you conceding that it may be a critical stage of the proceedings, but it's not critical enough in order to get a defense counsel?
I don't think it's a critical stage at all, but the reason I say that, there's two reasons. First, it's not a criminal proceeding. It's a civil proceeding. Second, you can't get more, you can only get less.
I know, but you wipe away the semantics for a minute. And here's a guy who, under the state's theory, okay, he's got 10 years, but he's got one chance in his lifetime to get that brought down to 9 years or 8 years or 7 years or 6 years or 5 years. It seems like it's a very critical proceeding from his standpoint. He's got a chance to cut it in half, doesn't he? Maybe it's not a real solid chance, but isn't that even more reason why you need a lawyer?
I don't know that having a lawyer makes a difference in what you get from the parole board on an indeterminate sentence. But nevertheless, I understand your question. That he has other chances to get less. He can go in for a parole. And in fact, if he follows his individual, his IPD, that says you got to do these things, he doesn't even have to go before the parole board. He just gets a parole. And so he has that chance to cut his sentence. He can, even if he doesn't make it on the presumptive parole, he can go in for discretionary parole after that. So he has that chance.
Don't
he can go in for a commutation.
Don't they set the sentence before the parole is eligibility is determined?
Yes.
This proceeding would actually be before he knows when he's eligible for parole.
That's correct.
Okay.
In fact, you have to do this before because you can't figure parole until you know how many years he has.
Now, I have this question. Do we need to even talk about, do we have to address the constitutional, whether or not they get a constitutional right to a lawyer? Because in this case, they actually gave him the right to a lawyer. They offered him that. They offered it to him in writing. And as I recall, didn't they also tell him that at the hearing or prior to the hearing or something? I just recall that, and it's been a while since I read the...
At the beginning of the hearing, and you probably know who was conducting the hearing, it was Bob Hofer, as I recall, who was a peer lawyer, and Mr. Hofer said... Now, Mr. Collins, it's the duty of the parole board at this time to set that sentence. You're not represented by a lawyer. Collins, no. Hofer, do you wish to be? Collins, no. Mr. Hofer, for the record, the state's represented by Hope Matchin. And then it goes on to conduct the hearing.
So why do we need to reach that issue? Because he was given the opportunity to have.
The circuit court found that he didn't make an intelligent and knowing waiver.
Do you agree with that?
No, I do not. I think the waiver takes care of it, but the circuit judge didn't agree with that. The circuit judge said, I don't think Mr. Collins knows enough to have made an intelligent waiver.
But wasn't there some question about what he was really being offered wasn't the chance to have a lawyer, but the chance to request a lawyer? Wasn't he told that he could ask for a lawyer if he was indigent?
Yes.
He could hire his own lawyer if he had the money, but there was some ambiguity there about whether he really was offered an attorney.
Well, here's what the written waiver says. If I cannot afford an attorney, I may request the sentencing court to appoint an attorney to represent me. This request may or may not be granted by the court. And that, I believe, is the state of the law, and I think he was correctly advised. And that's what his court-appointed attorney told him earlier.
But that's different than being offered a lawyer and waiving it, isn't it? I mean, he's being told, you still have to go to the judge and see if the judge will grant you one. No, that's different from being told you have a right to a lawyer.
I understand that. If he has a constitutional right to a lawyer, then it would be a little different question here. But if there isn't a constitutional right to a lawyer, I think the waiver is valid because he waived what the current state of the law was and I believe is.
But the circuit court judge found that he didn't waive it. That it wasn't a knowing, intelligent waiver, right?
That's correct.
So he's on this. He's on a different level than what you are as far as your argument is concerned.
That's correct. I disagree with the circuit court, and that's part of my appeal. I think under the state of the law, if you don't have a constitutional right to it, it was an adequate waiver. It may be an adequate waiver even if you do have a constitutional right to it. But, of course, that's for you to decide. The important part about this case to remember is it's not a criminal proceeding, and you can't get more. That's the most significant thing. The case law in South Dakota is clear that in parole board hearings, you don't have a Sixth Amendment, federal Sixth Amendment right. And it's pretty clear, I think, also you don't have a South Dakota right under the South Dakota Constitution. And by the way, both of those read almost identical. The case and the question comes down to this. This court has held in the 1010 currency case, $1,010 currency case, that there is a due process right if you can get more. If you can get a greater sentence, or if you can get a greater penalty, or if you could be called to incriminate yourself in the proceeding. Now here, Collins couldn't get a greater sentence. He couldn't get more than 10 years. All he could get was less. He couldn't, or at least you wouldn't think that he would incriminate himself when he's talking about this, because he's already been convicted of it. And so I don't think that he has a due process right either to an attorney.
Now, is the statutory, they do have a right to an attorney if, say, it's a suspended sentence, part of it's suspended, and the parole board determines that they're going to impose the suspended?
Yes.
You have a right to an attorney. Is that statutory?
Yes, that's in 2346. It says in a final proceeding for the revocation of parole or suspended sentence. So it would apply to a split sentence to the penitentiary, or to a circuit judge revoking a suspended sentence. For all these reasons, I think the court should reverse the circuit court and hold that there isn't a constitutional right. Remember, this is a habeas case. The only thing that the habeas can be granted for is if there's a constitutional right that is at issue here, because it isn't a question of was there jurisdiction. It's only, at best, a question of jurisdiction. So, since he couldn't get more, it's a civil proceeding, there's no constitutional right to an attorney, I would ask that the circuit court be reversed.
I have one more question. Does he have to show prejudice?
Well, I mentioned that in my brief. There's no indication that he would have gotten less, although everybody that goes before the board, I expect, wants less. So they all have that hope. But there's no indication. And, of course, I wasn't working for them then, so I can't tell you how that has gone. That's just something outside my knowledge and outside the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gores. Mr. Evans, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Henry Evans, and I'm here on the behalf of Mr. Rodney Collins. And I'm also here to demonstrate that, as counsel just pointed out, this is a habeas claim, and that Mr. Collins, underneath the unique facts and circumstances of his indeterminate sentencing hearing, had the right to counsel. And there are some valid issues here as to whether or not he waived it. He did. I mean, as the transcript was just read, he did do that. But Mr. Collins had wanted to have his attorney, John Hendricks, with him at the indeterminate sentencing hearing. And he had written Attorney Hendricks, and Attorney Hendricks said, I can't be there. But if the matter does come up, please preserve the issue for appeal. But at that point, Mr. Collins testified at the habeas hearing that he believed when his attorney had told him that, he just didn't have a right. He may have had the opportunity for it, may have been a bunch of paperwork, but he didn't have the right. The trial court concluded that Mr. Collins had an eighth grade education and had obtained his GED while being incarcerated in the South Dakota Department of Corrections, and that the opportunity or the distinction between having an absolute right to attorney versus applying for an attorney was not really fully appreciated by Mr. Collins.
But either way, didn't he say, I don't want an attorney?
He did say that, and I would have to concede that fact.
Does that end the question? Does that end the question, the lawsuit, the appeal?
On the one hand, it does, but on the other hand, that's sort of the purpose of habeas review, coming back and taking another look at that, to looking for constitutional violations, when his right really wasn't, that he didn't really fully appreciate his right to the counsel in that area. The other unique fact in this case was, and why it didn't end the question, is that having the prosecutor who was prosecuting you appear at the interment sentencing hearing to basically convince the parole board, you're going to want to give this man 10 years.
Was that her position that day?
That was her position that day. And basically, the transcript from the parole board hearing basically re-allegated out the facts of the crime that Mr. Collins had pled guilty to, so no really no benefit of the bargain, and basically with any doubt that the parole board may have had of maybe giving him 9 years or 8 years. Not necessarily the 50% discount, but even that too would have been put off because typically Mr. Carter at the time would have appeared there, and the fact that the state's attorney that was prosecuting appeared at this indeterminate sentencing hearing made this more like a quasi-sentencing than as an administrative parole board hearing.
So you're saying...
You go ahead.
You're saying then that the hearing itself dealt more with the underlying facts of the case as opposed to his behavior while he was incarcerated?
That's absolutely, Justice Meyer-Hanner. He began his incarceration March 2003. 6 months later, it was November when he was sentenced by the parole board. But all the facts that were really presented at the parole board hearing were more or less the underlying facts of the crime. And what he did was a horrible thing. I'm not up here to say he doesn't belong behind bars. Never said that at all, but the question is that this wasn't your typical indeterminate sentencing hearing. And Mr. Collins prepared for it. Mr. Hendricks, I want you here. I can't be there. I'm not allowed to be there. My scope of representation doesn't go on there. Gets the paperwork from the parole board in the mail, or in the prison mail. I'm not allowed to have an attorney, so I'm not going to fill it out. Geez, hope's there.
In view of what the assistant state's attorney, Hope Matchin, said, and in view of what she brought out, what is the answer to the question that's been asked of, do you have to show prejudice? Is it more than likely he's going to get 10 years at that point, in view of what she said, no matter who's representing him?
I would say that having the counsel there, as I argued at the habeas level, may have made an argument to mitigate down or to present a different picture of Mr. Collins than the Hope Matchin picture. Would that have resulted in 9 years or not? I don't know, Justice Abrams. It would still have been the 10 years? Possibly. But having the attorney there to shed the better light underneath of Mr. Collins is there, and that's where the state constitution comes into play, because the idea, and this is one language that the state constitution differs than the federal, that's to defend. That's the language that the South Dakota state constitution has. And this was an opportunity to have Mr. Collins be defended on what he did. Not that what he did was right or wrong, it was absolutely wrong, but to show some of the good characteristics and the possibility for rehabilitation for Mr. Cowens.
And Mr. Cowens testified that he didn't, based on everything he heard and read, he didn't believe he actually had a right to an attorney.
No, he did not.
And the court found that he was credible.
Right, and the reason why the court found that he was credible was that John Hendricks, who's now Judge Hendricks, also testified saying, look, this is how I advised my client, and this is where going on. And so this is where we don't have the habeas client being self-serving on the witness stand with after being in the prison attorney system. And as I cited in my brief, I can't think of the case, but I know that was a concern of the Chief Justice in a recent habeas decision of having self-serving testimony. But in this case, both Judge Hendricks, John Hendricks, Attorney Hendricks, and Mr. Cowens testified that I wanted to be there. I mean, Attorney Hendricks testified that had I known the state was going to do this and be there, and it wouldn't be your typical thing, I would have been there. He testified on cross-examination that he didn't care if he got paid by Minnehaha County or not. He wanted to be there because he saw the opportunity in there, which begs the question as to if we have the right to counsel, what standard do we use for a critical stage? And that's been one of the complexity of this case, because that critical stage for the attorney differs throughout South Dakota law, whether it's a termination of parental rights or whether it's an indeterminate sentence hearing as we saw here. And the limitation really has to be, as counsel for the parole board has argued, it's a case-by-case situation. But as this court did hold in 1010, the right to court-appointed counsel in criminal proceedings is an absolute statutory right. I didn't argue that in my brief. I apologize and I missed the issue on that, but that's what this court did argue in the time. And if the court's looking for a standard to adopt on when should the South Dakota right to counsel come into play, the court could adopt the Lassiter standard and the Matthews standards that were cited in 1010 on saying taken on a case-by-case situation.
And then part of the case-by-case in this is that it was adversarial because the state's attorney who prosecuted the case was actually present. Is that what you're saying?
It wasn't even being present. Like, let's say if this match was in the courtroom here today to see what would turn out. Not present in that sense. She was a present participating advocate. And if you look at the rules of conduct for an attorney, it distinguishes up different rules of conduct. And there she was being an advocate, not an advisory. And it was always my understanding that Mr. Carter or Mr. Gores, if he was in that situation, would have been advising to the parole board, saying, well, parole board, this is what you're going to want to do. But Ms. Matchin didn't take that role. And she's a seasoned prosecutor. I got a lot of respect for Ms. Matchin in a lot of ways. But at the same time, she was there to do her job. And that was to say,
if we're going to do this to a case-by-case basis, though, that'd be awfully difficult for courts and counsel when we're trying to define a right. If you're saying this is we're going to recognize a right on a case-by-case basis, what if the victims decide to show up at the parole hearing? Or what if the prosecutor doesn't show up but writes a letter? I mean, we've got all these different scenarios, and now the parole board is trying to decide, well, is this a time when we can have... I realize the statute's defunct, but still, when we're trying to recognize a right, it would seem to me we want a bright-line rule.
Absolutely, we don't want a bright-line rule. And that's where, if we're going to adopt a standard, the standard's got to be, is there going to be an adversarial atmosphere in that situation? And the indeterminate sentencing hearing is different than the hearing that might say you might see in the Berge case as to whether or not you're eligible for parole or not, whether or not you've paid your dues by not getting to trouble. This here, the actual sentence, was being imposed. And that's what makes this fact distinguishable from all the other parole board hearings that may happen. And that's where the court has got to have a standard, or any type of quasi-judicial branch may have a standard that says if this looks adversarial, then we may need to advise the other people of the adversarial and attach that right.
If we go with you, if we affirm this case, does that open the floodgates to all the other people in the penitentiaries throughout the state of South Dakota who's ever had an indeterminate sentence but didn't have an attorney at the hearing?
I would say no.
And why is that?
The reason why is that this indeterminate sentence hearing was unique because the prosecutor who was prosecuting the case appeared before that. And that if the floodgate is open, the floodgate should be worked out to see who was at that parole board hearing. If it was Mr. Carter serving in his role, not as a deputy state's attorney, but rather as the attorney to the parole board, that's a distinguishable fact.
And that'd be mind-boggling in the first place. What if the state's attorney shows up or the regular person who shows up and he argues to beat hell and comes up with all the factual arguments in the world why the guy should get the max and it should stay at the max? I mean, you can't do it based on the personality or the argument of whoever appears. Can you?
I would say in this fact pattern, I think you can't, because the parole board attorney is different than the state's attorney that would be coming. Two different functions. One's going to be advising, looking at how has this inmate behaved himself or herself, versus, geez, we wanted to prosecute him on this, but we couldn't. Or if we were going to oppose a big sentence on here, he got the benefit of the bargain, we could have, you know, charged A, B, C, and D here, so give him the 10 years. All the criminal facts or all the facts that are underlining the plea bargain are now being eloquated before the parole board. While if it's just a parole board attorney, that might say, this defendant, Mr. Cowens, pled guilty to a very serious crime. This is the evidence, and this is the judge, and this is so far, we don't have enough time to tell whether he's going to be a good inmate or a bad inmate. And so you do your job, parole board. And I think there's a distinction on that with those two types of attorneys that are advising the parole board. One is advising, looking at the facts of Rodney Cowens when he walks into the pen after Judge Keene sentenced him to it, whether it was 5 years or whether it was 10 years, versus, geez, I didn't get my sentencing argument for Judge Keene, so I'll get it now. And then making that argument forward. That was a very clear argument I think she made, but at the same time, I don't know if Mr. Hendricks would have been able to mitigate down any time or not. That's one of the mysterious parts of sentences. You just don't know. But having a person there to defend him, to make a person that's going to be, and at that point he is, Mr. Cowens was an inmate in South Dakota prison, so the inmate personality is starting to come over. What I mean by that is possibly remorse. Possibly I'm not seeing sunshine anymore because I got the jail gate falling in front of me. And I'm really numbed as to what to say or what not to say, as anybody would be before a sentence, and it's, I got to do this again.
What's your position on the majority rule? It seems to be that when a court gives an indeterminate sentence, it's considered, the high level is considered to be the maximum sentence, and therefore whatever happens when the parole board sets the actual sentence, it's merely an administrative procedure, not a judicial procedure.
I'd still argue, and this is how I've got habeas jurisdiction, is that through the statute where the court is able to transfer its authority to imprison a person, basically the parole board is sitting in the shoes of the judge, and which,
if you say that, then what's for us to stop us from going to the next step and saying, well, discretionary parole hearings are, in a sense, the judge giving some power to the executive branch to decide it?
Not necessarily, because the statutes are different on that, Justice Konenkamp, because at that point it becomes clearly the part of the executive branch. At that point, because the sentence has already been imposed. Here, the controlling fact is that Mr. Cowens didn't know what his sentence was going to be. He knew 10 was going to be the same. And granted, I will concede that if he appeared before Judge King could have sentenced him outside of those.
These other courts have said that the inmate does know. They know because they know the highest, they know the maximum level. So Mr. Cowens knew he had 10 years. The only thing he didn't know is whether the parole board was going to reduce it.
That's correct.
Same question that the parole board answers when they're granting discretionary parole.
That is the same question in that sense.
Do you know how many jurisdictions actually have an indeterminate sentence?
No, Your Honor, I don't.
California gives a lot of them because I see they've got quite a few cases about it.
But at the same time, going back to your question, Justice Konenkamp, is that Mr. Cowens knew as part of his benefit of the bargain, too, before Judge Keene, he was still looking at 10 years. So that's still that expectation of...
Well, I'm not clear on what you're saying. You mean that the court, that there was a plea bargain that he would just get an indeterminate sentence and that he could argue later that what his sentence...
No, that wasn't part of the plea at all. It was basically he was looking at a cap, I believe.
Okay.
And
the cap was 10 years. Must have been.
Yeah, and in that point of view, it's, you know, he's still having that same expectation, but still the possibility of something less was still there. Just that expectation he had that when he walked in and pled guilty and did the change of plea hearing with his attorney, with Judge Keene, back at the courthouse. And in that sense, I think factually it may be very esoteric, and maybe I might be splitting hairs, but I would say that is different than the discretionary parole situation, which the state and the felon has raised, because in that point, there's no doubt that you can't get anything less. And at that point, it's up for the parole board. You've got to be rewarded for good behavior. Here, Mr. Cowens didn't get that 6 months good behavior consideration. It was, hey, you got 10 years, so why have a hearing?
Well, do you... Obviously, by statute, they do. He has a right on a suspended sentence, which this is very similar to. But this case, they didn't include that in the statutory requirement. So it has to be then a constitutional.
Mm-hmm.
This is a bigger hurdle.
That is a bigger hurdle that we have here. But at the same time, South Dakota has, through different areas, have expanded out that right to counsel, that ability to defend the person, whether it's the parent standing before an A&N case or the inmate that's going to be sentenced to be.
But we'd have to decide that this was a critical stage.
That's right. And if the critical stage isn't there, Mr. Collins is out. No doubt about it. And the question is, as a matter of law, and this is what I do agree with Mr. Gores, is that there is a de novo review. It is whether or not, you know, these findings of, you know, the conclusions of law, this court's been very clear on its habeas standards, is it's a first case of first impression, and it's de novo. But at the same time, we've got, if there is that right to counsel, which I'm saying, how do we limit it in a fair and reasonable way so that way nobody else will be coming in, whether it's marriage issues to whatever issues, underneath trying to expand civil liberties underneath the South Dakota Constitution. And that's why with these facts, you have that case. To take the same standard that Lassiter and the Matthews that the U.S. Supreme Court did, look at the facts of the circumstances and go in. The issue here is, what's the relief for Mr. Collins? To get to the meat of the argument, and that is, he possibly could have another parole board hearing. Whether I'm there with them or Ms. Matchin's there with them or not, that's to be decided. But the possibility of him returning back for less time would make him more eligible for his IPD parole that Mr. Gorse was sounding about. And he is parole eligible, Mr. Collins is, in September coming up. I got about a minute and a half left. I don't know if you got any more questions or not, but I do thank you for the opportunity to look at this question.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Evans. Mr. Gorse, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Mr. Evans has a different view of my job than I do. When I appear at a parole hearing, I not only tell the parole board or offer evidence on what has happened in the penitentiary, but I also offer evidence about what the person did, even things that the person wasn't charged with or that were dismissed in a plea bargain, or even if that person was acquitted, because there's a different standard of proof. And so even an acquittal isn't res judicata. I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead and finish.
No, that's fine.
How many indeterminate sentences were there in, I mean, I was on the circuit court bench a long time. I don't think I ever gave one. How many are there up there?
I have made every effort to find out, and it's difficult. I calculate that there are a minimum of 7. And there could be many more than that. There were a few judges that liked to give them, Judge Keene and Judge Sirska. I gave one and said, I'm not doing that again.
I think I was with you on that.
You know, To my knowledge, that may have been why it was repealed. In fact, I remember that it was repealed years ago, and then Judge Keene liked it so much, he went and got it passed again, and then it was repealed again. So this isn't a huge issue, but the issue is important because it stretches not only to indeterminate sentences, but to the other things that we do. We get, and there are statutory things that the parole board can do. When the institution sets a parole date, the inmate has a statutory right to appeal to the parole board to have that setting reviewed. Do we have to give an attorney to the inmate at that point? The inmate also has a right to appeal the conditions that the parole staff puts on the parole plan. Not the IPD, but the conditions. If you get out, you have to not drink and all those things you don't do. All right. And oftentimes inmates will appeal the parole conditions. Do we have to give them a lawyer for that? And do we have to start giving them lawyers at pardon hearings? The circuit court has to do it. We don't have any authority to appoint lawyers when I say we. But does the state of South Dakota, who I represent, need to give lawyers at pardon hearings, at commutation hearings, at all these different kinds of hearings that certainly are important to the inmate as well as the state? The state has an interest here too in protecting public safety and keeping dangerous criminals in as long as it's necessary to do so.
Do you have anything to say about the floodgate, open the floodgate argument?
You know, I don't think that that's a good argument to use in an appellate court because if the floodgates open, then I just have job security. Quite frankly, that's a good thing in this economy, Your Honor. And
Mr. Evans stays busy too then.
Exactly. I'm worried not about the floodgates of past inmates, but about opening
related proceedings or
unrelated proceedings or future proceedings where this issue might continue to creep into the civil law. These are civil administrative hearings in the executive branch. They're not criminal proceedings. And I don't think that the right to court-appointed counsel should go any further than the legislature extends it in a statute. Or I suppose that it's possible that a judge would say, okay, I think Rodney Collins needs a lawyer at this hearing. I still think a judge can probably do that because we tell them that. You can apply. And our experience is sometimes they get a lawyer and most of the time they don't. I want to differ very briefly with Mr. Evans about the state and federal constitution. The two read almost identical. They both say, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall have or shall enjoy and the right to counsel to defend, or the federal constitution says, for his defense. Our state court has said on several occasions, this is the same thing. They're identical. So I don't think there's a greater right under the state constitution than there is under the federal constitution.
What bothers me a little bit is that when you make an indeterminate sentence in a criminal proceeding and you're really deferring your decision 5 to 10 years, you're really just delaying the criminal proceeding, aren't you? And you're passing it on to somebody else to make the determination of 5 or 10 years?
I think the original thought was, let's see how this guy does in prison. The practice that the parole board has employed has been to do it fairly soon because you need to get a parole date set. In Collins' case, if he had gotten a 5-year sentence instead of a 10-year sentence, he would have been eligible as a fifth-time felon. He would have been eligible in 0.65, 65% So he'd have been eligible in 39 months. Now, if after the 8 months that it took before they set his sentence and the 39, if you're going to do any program, if you're going to have an individual program directive that does anything for the inmate to prepare him for the outside and gives you an opportunity to say, yes, he's entitled to a presumptive parole or no, he isn't, you have to get that done right away. So as a practice, it doesn't defer it very long. The practice has been to set them within a year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gores. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.